Hi, y'all. We are back for another episode and really excited for this one because we are going to talk about a large survey that Elizabeth or Beth Dutera is putting together. So Beth is an autistic teacher and content creator. She has the account Ought to Ask, which I think is just so creative. And she's putting together this big survey. So we're going to talk through some of the findings so far that have popped up, as well as some of her advocacy work that she's doing. She really is taking the lead and really trying to make a difference in this autism space.
Welcome to a parenting space actually designed for you, where you can get answers about navigating a life that includes autism. I'm Dr. Tay, a licensed child psychologist and parental coach specializing in neurodivergent affirming care. I have supported hundreds of autistic children and their families and have been in the autism field for over a decade. And I know firsthand the impact autism can have. I was 12 years old when my little brother was diagnosed and my family had to learn how to navigate the autism journey. It wasn't always easy. 2 decades later, I now create resources and services I wish my family had, including this podcast. And I developed the whole family approach. On this podcast, of course, we will talk about autism, but we will also talk about your personal growth and well-being as a parent, supporting your non-autistic children, and sharing personal stories of other families so you know you're not alone. Quick disclaimer before we jump into today's episode. Anything shared on this podcast should not be considered clinical advice, and you should consult with your team of medical, mental health, and developmental providers if you need support.
Really excited to have Beth on the podcast today. Welcome, Beth.
Hello. Thanks for having me.
You are so welcome. Yeah, excited to have you here and to chat through some of this today.
There's so much to cover.
I know. We're both talkers, and so there's so much data that we'll have to try to make this succinct, but we also want to make sure that largely this is parents listening, that they hear some of these really cool findings and input that you've been getting. But before we dive into talking about the survey and your advocacy work, kick us off a little bit. Tell me about your journey of like with autism and what that looked like.
Sure. Interestingly enough, I found out I am autistic through one of my students years ago that I had. And she was just, she needed more supports than most people. And I remember going home one day, because I was looking for how to best support her. As all teachers, still, what can we do?
Right.
What more can we do? So I went home and I was talking to my parents and I was describing everything about her. And my parents were like, that sounds exactly like you did as a child. And it just hit all of us at once that we were like, oh. And my dad calls it was the missing piece of my puzzle, because all my life we've been trying to find out answers as mothers do and parents do. And I was nonverbal until I was like 4.
Wow.
Went to a lot of speech. And then I got diagnosed with ADHD, OCD, general anxiety.
And it goes on and on.
Yes.
Yes.
Basically, it does. And then, so autism, was the missing piece that makes it all make sense.
Yeah.
And that kind of leads me into why I got started doing this. I was so amped up that how the hell did I not know I was autistic?
Yeah. Do you mind me asking? So how old were you when this all happened?
After 30.
Okay.
So, low 30s. But it just astounded me that I had no idea. And I was autistic. Mm-hmm. And I thought I was aware of autism. And I teach autistic kids, not primarily, but some of them. And it just, we know so little as a society. And we just think, oh yeah, autism exists. We're aware. But it's not that. As it's, no, you don't know. I got really knee deep into just research, and that led me to feel that I need more support, and it makes sense now, because with an autistic lens, like why I wasn't making, why I still live at home with my parents, why I can't drive on highways, stuff like that. It makes more sense looking at it through an autistic lens rather than I'm lazy or I didn't catch up or.
Yeah. So, or it's anxiety, right? Like probably with driving, that's coming into play.
Absolutely.
And it is, but having this understanding of autism really helps to shift the game and the understanding. And it's funny you use real quick the analogy of the puzzle, because it's funny. I'm always a little, I don't know, there's the history of the puzzle piece within autism, but I actually think putting that part aside, the idea of a puzzle is so helpful where it's all of these pieces of who an individual is. And it's not until we start putting things together and getting clarity that we start to understand the full picture. And I feel like that's what you were saying there.
Absolutely.
Is, yeah.
Yes.
Yeah.
It is funny about the puzzle piece, but it is.
Yeah.
Exactly that. So I realize looking through it in that lens, I'm not lazy. I need more supports. And so I start looking for more, and there's nothing out there for autistic adults. There's very little for teens, and even there's not much for kids. It's just everyone. We all need more.
Yeah.
So let me start a survey to see if I was the only one. And I'm not.
No.
As the results kept coming and coming, it's clear we all need more help.
One of the most interesting things, and it's a really interesting conundrum for me, I will get comments on my posts of, it's not just autistic kids, it's all autistic adults too. Like, stop saying that about kids. And it's a conundrum for me because I am trained as a child psychologist and I want to stay within my scope of practice and all of that. But I always try to validate when someone comments that. I'm like, you're right. And just try to explain, like, but it's weird because there's such a gap for services as individuals age. It's in general, it's hard to find services, but it gets worse as people age. I love what I do and it's how I was trained. And actually one of the goals of my practice is to start adding other psychologists who can help and work with teens and adults, but it's also this balance of I don't, but at the same point, we need more. Both can
be true. Exactly. Yes. So,
yeah.
And it is hard online because you say one thing and there's 50 other people that are like, no. And then there's 50 other people that are yes. Let's all have all of our voices heard. And that's another aspect of the survey. Your voice matters. Your voice, we don't have to agree.
Exactly. Absolutely. Yeah. I think it's so helpful to hear your story and all of it and the lens in which you were interpreting things pre-autism clarity versus post-autism clarity. And I know that there's parents listening to this right now. Their child is autistic and they might be going, is this a part of my journey? Or maybe they've identified already as autistic. I'm curious, did you end up getting a diagnostic evaluation or did you find that not to be the route you wanted to go?
So I did. I approached my doctor about it, my therapist and my psychiatrist just to talk about it. Mm-hmm. And they all agree, you're autistic, but I didn't seek the need to get evaluate it because I don't get any extra supports if I do.
No, it's a very huge point in this.
If I did, I absolutely would. And I know a lot of people need the validation of it. But for me personally, everything's crystal clear. And I'm not saying I'm more or less, not at all, but I don't need validation.
No, everyone's journey is different. And I think that self-identification piece is so incredibly valid. And sometimes people want that calibration or someone else to say, yes, I'm seeing it as well. I think it's a really interesting point though, because as a child psychologist, all the time I talk about how important having your child evaluated for autism is because it does increase access to services, right? But for adults, it often doesn't. And sometimes there even can be was balancing pros and cons for adults. Sometimes there's more cons than there are pros to it.
Yeah.
Going through that
needs to change. But that's,
yeah.
But hopefully all of us are trying to work towards.
Absolutely.
On the other side of it, the imposter syndrome is what it is. And that does sound awful, but I never had that, is what I'm saying.
Yeah. Yeah. No, that makes total sense. And I think that's an important piece and for others to hear that, like,
those are valid.
Yeah. Exactly. Exactly. You don't have to go and get that diagnostic evaluation. Real quick on timeline, when did you start your Ought to Ask account? And then when did you also start the survey?
So I started the survey maybe December 2022. I was pumping it out as much, but it was just like, here it is. Like, here and there, I would post about it. And then I think I posted it on one group on Facebook, on my personal page, and I got 800. And I was like, wow. And I think that's what triggered me into going harder with this. So I took to Twitter after that. And then I got much more. And then after Twitter, I was like, also, by the way, I wanted to be as anonymous as I could with this. Like, okay. I can't now. But at the beginning, I was pushing the limit of how far I could go without, you know, not being here. But I'm happy to be the face if I have to be. But Twitter. And then I went to my personal Instagram account with it. And then I was realizing I really should get a sole account for this, just to advocate. And that's just been since November of this.
Yeah. Wow. Your account has grown quite rapidly then.
That's what people say. Yeah. Which is great. But at the same time, it's scary because I don't want my voice to overshadow anyone else. It's so whatever, come as it is. But yes. Yeah.
Oh, that's amazing. So right now, do you have an idea of how many people have filled out this survey?
Yes. So over 1,800.
Wow. That's so cool.
And I printed out like open-ended questions, the answers. If you can see, we obviously can't go through them all, but there's quite a lot.
Yeah.
People have a lot to say.
Yeah.
I struck you wanna, out.
Let's just do it. We're going to make it super random. So who knows what's going to show up right now. Go ahead and pick three different random things. Just grab one, read it, and then we'll talk about it. Let's do it.
Okay. Support. The question was, what do you want more people to know about autism?
Perfect.
One answer says, support for burnout, specifically tailored to autistic people, would be huge. I needed that a few years ago, and nothing helped. In fact, parts of my life got worse despite the non-autistic people who tried to help. A mentor and a therapist. They were professionals and trying to be kind, but it did not help. Currently, I'd love to have an autistic therapist, coach, or advisor to help with my anxiety and other things that come up to life.
Wow. And actually, by the time our episode airs, I would have had another psychologist on, and we were talking all about autistic burnout on that episode. So it should only be, when y'all are listening to this, a couple episodes ago with Dr. Donna Henderson. She is an amazing advocate in this space. She is not autistic, but she is neurodivergent, but we were talking about that. And I think sometimes things can be very well-intentioned and miss the mark.
Yes. Just like she said, they're kind, but it just didn't help.
Yep. Absolutely. So,
that was one. Some of them are pretty hot. I'm going to avoid them. They're very angry. Some of these people are very angry.
And that makes sense because for so long they haven't had a place to feel seen and heard. And then absolutely, to finally have this place, it's so validating.
Just tell me everything you want. Yep. And a lot of it is anonymous. Yep. There's an optional. So I think that even made people more honest and raw.
Yeah.
But okay, let's see. As a physically disabled individual, it is easier for me to be exposed to information about autism. I have a personal interest in inclusivity, but I do not know how much non-autistics are exposed to autism or neurodivergent perceptions and info. I believe all disabled people need to advocate for accessibility together. That's a good point, too. Before I knew I was autistic, I didn't have any idea either. And right. That's what she's saying.
And sometimes, too, I think there's a difference of being aware versus being only aware of the stereotypical kind of presentations yes. of autism. Yes. Those are two very different things. So I talk a lot on the podcast, and this isn't a slight to pediatricians, but I find because of their training, pediatricians who often refer to people like me have this very stereotypical lens of autism. I will say, and I probably get more than the average just with my, how I advocate, my platform, all sure. of that. But yeah. I also think that, and being, I'm an out-of-network provider with insurance, and so that means they don't need the referral. But I get so many parents that are like, yeah, my pediatrician told me I was crazy. And then I'm saying, your child is autistic. And so I think that's a difference that comes to mind for me. But a question that I have for you, and I'm curious, both maybe in terms of looking at the data, but also your lived experience is, autistic individuals doing the advocacy piece, like how much of that burden should be on them versus how much of the burden needs to be on non-autistic individuals? Because it is a lot of burden, right?
That's a great question. Yes. What I find is nobody gives a shit about any of this unless they're in the community. I have all these stats and stuff. To say it's on them and their burden to learn isn't going to get us anywhere. They don't, it doesn't affect them. And it's okay that they just don't seem to care. It's on us, I think, to show them why it does affect you as a whole, as a society. It does affect everything. Improving our lives will improve your life this way or that. So I do think the burden should be more so on autistic people to bridge the gap sort of thing.
Yeah. It's complicated, right?
And a lot of autistic advocates are burned out and they're tired of doing this. Right. And that's valid. And it does burn you out. And I just tell them, hey, it's okay. You take a break. We'll take the wheels. And then we'll take a break. And he breaks the gun. But
yeah, I think what's really interesting, so I do not identify as autistic, but I have an autistic brother, which is how I got into this field. Clearly, I specialize in autism as well. And I almost liken it to like with LGBTQIA+, there's being in the community and then there's allies that can also be voices. And so that's one of the things that I try to do. But also at the same time, a huge part of this is how I view it. A huge part of my role is to help spread acceptance, but is also to empower autistic voices, right? I can never speak on that lived experience.
Sure. Yes.
You know, and so that is where we do have to rely on autistic people to be able to speak up. But I think there's a balance here, and we need, which I know is something, and we're going to get to the end of the episode, something you're working to change of in terms of laws and regulations and all of that and advocacy. We do need non-autistic people who are not somehow connected to the community to step up though, too.
Yeah. I don't want to veer too far because I had another thought. But do you want me to read another one?
Do you have a thought? Go ahead.
Yeah, I do. But you said we'll get to it at the end.
It's okay, perfect. So, sounds good. Okay. Yeah. We can definitely dive into another one. But I'm glad we're doing this because we're hearing from other autistic voices simultaneously to having this conversation about some really important topics.
That's my point, too. So I do have a bunch of emails of these people, and I am trying to connect them to newspapers or writers and editors. I'm like, hey, write about autism. I have voices. It's not just mine. I have this. I have, yeah.
That's incredible.
There's a lot of people that want more affordable therapy, which makes sense.
Yeah.
And jobs are really important. There's a lot of people saying we need help with jobs.
Yeah.
I'm not sure. You're probably familiar, but there's a stat that says 85% of college-educated autistics are unemployed. Mm. And these are college-educated, so they're capable, you would think. And we're not utilizing them. But yet you want to talk about the economy and stuff. Here's a huge, talented market of people.
Right. And we're seeing so many people that don't want to work right now that we know that's a reality in our country. There's been a huge shift since the pandemic, but yet is that an accurate statistic when we think about 85% of autistic college educated individuals aren't employed? Like probably not.
Probably not. Yeah, it's probably, what about the ones that didn't go to college that are still capable of work?
Yeah.
Or the ones that are undiagnosed? That are capable. Totally. So it's just, it's maddening when you think of all these issues.
Yeah.
And it's like a David and Goliath kind of thing.
Because some of it is, okay, we need to do a better job of prepping people, but we also have to prep the industries for this. So I know when we first connected, I think I mentioned to you, Chris Bonello from Autistic Not Weird. Huh? We have an episode together where we were talking about like the workplace and being able to have necessary accommodations. And I think so he speaks about this. It's something he trains companies on of how do you actually be inclusive and affirming and accommodating? Because I think one of the challenges is so many companies either say they are or don't even realize they need to be. So
exactly. And I think that's the bigger issue is they don't even know that they need to be.
Totally. I'm debating, but I think I'm going to go there of, do we mention this more affordable therapy? Because I have a lot of thoughts on it.
You too.
Yeah. You start. You kick us off.
I would love more affordable therapy. Currently, I am in the best therapy, but I see a student who is...
Yeah.
Like an intern kind of thing.
Good.
And she's amazing. And I posted about it on my page. I'm like, therapy can be expensive, but it can be affordable. You just have to look outside. And the best therapies are out of pocket, usually. It's the truth.
Yeah.
But yeah, I'm in the Philadelphia area. So I have a lot of access to great therapists. But you don't even need that nowadays because it's Zoom. So you can just, we do need more affordable, but I see a student and an intern.
Well, and every therapist started like that, right? I was a student for, basically I was in training before I became independently licensed for 8 years, or it might've been seven-ish, but it was almost.
You were a student for seven?
I was in grad school for 6 years. That whole time I'm being supervised.
Sure.
And then once I finally graduated with my PhD, that was after 6 years, then I still have to do all of these hours for licensure. And so I think it ended up being almost 2 full years by the time that my license came through. It was like April of 2022. It wasn't that, 2022? Yeah. It wasn't that long ago. I graduated in July of 2020. So that's the thing. And it's a great way. And one of the advantages I would argue of that is these individuals are often really wanting to learn. They're willing to put in the energy to learn. Their education and the access of things that they're being taught might be more up to date than someone who's been in the field for 10 plus years. So,
and they do have the colleague that you said that they helps them. So it's like a 2-for-1 deal. Like
it is a 2-for-1. Yeah. No,
you know? I love her. And I will say to everyone, look at students or interns.
Yeah. It is complex. And one of the things being in the mental health field, and I already said to you, I actually am out of pocket. I'm not directly networked in network with insurance. And while I'm not going to use this to talk about the reasons why, what I will say is that our mental health care field is like suffering as a whole. Yeah. And it's one of these things where it just is not thriving in many ways. It's failing. And so I recognize, and I talk about that a lot. Yes, I'm out of network and I recognize that everyone can't afford access to care. And it's one of the reasons I started this podcast. This podcast is not intended to replace therapy in any sorts of the mean, at least getting access to some free information.
Yeah.
But it's super complicated, and it's not just within the autism space, although I think it's greatly magnified within the autism space because so few clinicians are trained on autism and neurodiversity and all of that. And actually Dr. Donna Henderson, who I mentioned already, she ended up writing a book. It's called Is This Autism? And she did it because there's so many clinicians that are just afraid to support autistic individuals, and not a fear way of like, I don't want to, in a fear of I don't want to do something wrong, but it's also at the same point, like it's creating such a limiting factor in addition to our mental health.
That's a great point. Good book then. Yeah.
It's a great one. So
I'll have to check it out.
Yeah. So these are some amazing comments. I know you also sent me some graphs ahead of time, and I have them pulled up here, but I think there's some interesting data.
Real quick, just a brief interruption, because I want you to know you don't have to navigate this journey alone. If you're in a place where you have concerns about your child's development, you've been on the search for a therapist that provides evidence-informed neurodivergent affirming care, or you're needing more support as a parent, the whole family approach may be a good fit for you. Autism doesn't just impact your child's life, so you deserve care that works for your child and your whole family. Head to the link in the show notes to schedule a complimentary call where we can chat about your unique circumstances. We can help you decide if Dr. Tay Concierge Clinical Care would be a good fit for your family. And if not, we will provide you resources for your next best steps.
So the first one is, am I satisfied with the resources and supports available to me? And it looks like you had an option that says what supports, 18.1%, not at all was 37.4%, and somewhat was 41.9%. I'm not doing them.
Wasn't it?
That's what I was about to say. It's super, super tiny. I don't know adding that up, but we're in the ballpark of less than 10% are saying that they're receiving the supports that they need.
Insane.
Yeah.
Insane. Yeah.
It is.
And this is just a microcosm. Yeah.
Absolutely. And just to contextualize this, it looks like about half, does this feel accurate to you? About like half of the responses were directly from autistic people?
Yes. And then there's one chunk that says the parents, which is the second largest chunk. And then there's a bunch of ones that people were like autistic and a teacher, autistic and a parent. They are also autistic.
Okay.
But they just were identified as autistic and something else.
Yeah. Okay. That makes a lot of sense. And so here's a really interesting one that goes back to our conversation about more affordable therapy. Would you be willing to pay for additional services? And 41.3% said yes. 21.3% said no. And then there were lots of different like option of depends, possibly I have co-pays. Mm-hmm. Is it affordable? Is it covered by insurance? All these different factors. Finances, I guess I would summarize it this way. While finances are a factor in this, at the same point, there are individuals that even despite finances are still feeling difficulty in being able to access the services they need.
Absolutely. I actually put that question in my head to show that these people, we don't have the money to do it. So that was my intention, that most of them would say no. But what's shocking is they probably don't have the money, but they just need it so bad that they are willing to, which speaks volumes too.
Yeah.
That wasn't really what I was expecting, but.
Really? Okay.
Yeah. I was expecting most to say no.
Right.
Or I can't afford it.
Right. Right. That makes sense. Yeah. Super interesting. Okay. This one, I have some strong opinions on this. So the question is, would you prefer a cure for autism or to better understand autism? And so it was like an either or, and 89.9% said better understanding, and then 10.1% said a cure. Yeah. Any kind of the qualitative data that you, as you were digging through it, things that you want to share about this?
Yes. So that was a super hot topic. And I also had reasons for showing that. I want better understanding, but I wanted it to show, be clear when I showed people, policymakers or these organizations, I wanted it to be clear to show them, look.
That's genius. I never thought about it.
That's why I included it. And because, as I say all the time, we're louder together. So it's one thing to say, I want better supports, better understanding, no cure. But it's a different thing to show this. Look, all these people, you know, like it's, but yeah, a lot of people wrote, this is awful that you even have that option. But in my head, I have it for a reason.
Right. Oh, that makes that makes sense. People that really embrace neurodiversity and neurodivergent affirming supports would be like, and I will say when I saw it too, I was like, huh, but that
what kind of survey is this? Yes.
I think the other side of it though, too, it's interesting. I posted a reel about not curing autism and how there wasn't a cure. And it was intentionally like a fiery reel that I just had some emotion to get it out.
Yes.
But even within that of me being really explicit, there aren't cures. And here's the reason we don't want to seek cures is we don't want that person to feel like they're constantly needing to be fixed or improved or to change something about themselves. That's not good for like their emotional well-being and all of that. But without fail, you know, I had people in my comments talking about cures and all of that. And
that's
then
the answer. Whatever. Look at it. Yeah.
Exactly. And telling me, actually, I was uneducated. And I'm like, okay, we just view this differently. But I also think it's interesting data in the sense of, I think it's interesting to think about because I think neurodiversity has made such a charge in so many ways, like for the better, and we want that. There's still many people within the autism community that this idea of neurodiversity isn't reaching yet. And my guess, every type of survey you put out probably is going to have some sort of bias. It's the nature of research.
Of course.
Yours probably is a little bit more biased towards people that identify as autistic or believe in neurodiversity. So it's interesting to think that even with that, you're at 10%. What would it be like if you were reaching people that really were wanting to go for a cure?
And that's why I did have the option to say, I'm not autistic. Because I did want to see, did they want a cure?
Yeah.
To compare all the data. But it's fascinating.
It's
all
so
of it.
Fascinating. Yeah. And I love the intentionality. You knew you didn't make this survey just for people to feel seen and heard. It's part of the benefits, but you have a really large mission you're going.
I did. I always knew I wanted to take this to somewhere. Whether it be my local like autism center or whether it be, I just want someone to hear us. Like these people are screaming, like you see these stories.
Yeah.
So I just, and I do, I have many ideas that I have in my head before I even started the survey. And so I did craft it in such a way that I wanted it to be, I wanted it to get hit a nerve and have people say, like, fuck you, or like, oh, I love that. Like, I wanted the passion. I wanted it all to show whoever I show.
Yeah.
Which is a different issue.
That's such a good point to hit a nerve a little bit because you're getting the unfiltered thoughts. And those are important. To be able to communicate to people in these systems that are making decisions of this is really what people are experiencing.
Yeah, it's one thing to say, oh, I want better understanding. But it's a different thing if I get an email from someone and it's, you are awful. This is why we cannot have a cure. And it's one thing to show these people these, like the passion behind it. Wow. So.
Wow. There is so much giftedness in this survey that like it's blowing
my mind. I'm so happy that you see it and you're giving me a voice to talk about it. Because
oh my gosh, when I was like, it clicked on, I was like scrolling and you tagged me in a lot and I'm more than happy to jump in and comment and support. And all of a sudden I was like, wait, let's have her on the podcast. It just had never clicked to me. Right. And I asked you and you're like, yeah, let's do it.
Yes, yeah. I would love to. So yes, I'm happy to, and not just you, I'm always like, anyone wants to hear any of these, it's a red light. I'm like, please.
Yep.
Absolutely. Welcome. DM me, whatever.
Yeah.
Yes.
One point that I have, and then I want to get some more specifically a little into the advocacy work, but I thought about this understanding versus cure. I don't, just to say this point, I think it's really interesting because in the research space, we haven't seen the neurodiversity movement really be incorporated into research. And so much is actually still focused on a cure. Or if it's not focused on a cure, like maybe they don't say those words, it's all about improving autism symptoms, which is indirectly related to a cure. And so it's fascinating too, to think at a governmental level, which I know this is something you care a lot about, like how research is getting funded, right? Is the large majority of autistic individuals don't actually feel seen and heard through the research that's being funded. And yet literally autism, I used to be in research. So I worked in academia. Autism is one of the most well-funded like topics, right? Billions of dollars going towards it. We're passionate about it, but it's super fascinating too, because even on, not only is that the problem, but it's also, there's not a lot of research that's supported on improving quality of life, right? They're still trying to understand like mechanisms of autism and
DNA or
exactly. And well, there is some of it that's important that could increase identification.
I agree.
But that it doesn't translate to the clinical application or to the lived experience of autism.
Absolutely. Yeah. Absolutely. Do you mind if I talk about some research papers that I did?
Yeah, okay. Let's do it. I hope I'm not in there, like in a bad way, because
no, I did. I am very passionate. And like I said, I have ideas and I want both sides of this, the devil's advocacy, because I want to prove it wrong. So I went to the library. I got lots of peer-reviewed stuff. And what struck me is, none of these have autistic voices in them. Right. None of them. I have only seen a few. I can't speak for.
Yeah. There are some for sure, but it's it's such a minor proportion.
And it's what boggles me from a teacher's point of view too, is the scientists are trying to improve education systems for students and teachers, but they're not in the fucking classroom. Mm-hmm. So I'm like, how do you think? One in particular was like talking about giving autistic kids report cards every day.
Daily report cards. We talked about this on your social media.
Yeah.
Yes.
And what struck me as, where do these researchers think these teachers have extra time and resources to devote and be like, yes, I would love this extra work.
Right.
Teachers are maxed out.
Totally. Yeah.
Why don't we help them instead of give them more busy work?
Yeah.
Because the report cards did not work. What it was said, what I found was they were trying to find bad behaviors were like stimming behaviors.
Right.
But they were calling it bad.
Yeah. Compliance is what they're
exactly. Yeah. And this is just one of many, but it has its place for sure.
Yeah.
But open it up to different perspectives.
Yeah.
Invite us in.
Yeah. And it's fascinating coming from the research field. A huge part of why I left is I didn't feel like I was having impact. I felt like I was doing the same thing over and over again. And okay. what I started to realize is like, what legacy is this going to leave at for me as a human being? Like, okay, I have all these research papers and I got all these grants. And yes, it might have an impact, but the stuff that I really felt passionate about studying was going to be many years away. And so that was a big piece. And yeah, it didn't feel applicable and like it was actually changing lives. And yeah, but I know I contributed to that. I think I have, to be candid, like 25-ish publications. I can't think of one.
To look into them.
I know, but I'm going to give this. I can't think of one that we incorporated autistic voices. And that's a problem. And I now realize that I didn't, a version of me several years ago didn't, but
it's not your fault.
Right. It's the system, right? Yeah. Just in many ways, like this stat blew me away. And I think you'll enjoy this as an educator talking about, and I wish I remember the exact stat, but it was something like 18%. They estimate 18% of students are neurodivergent. And why are we then teaching to the neurotypical standard and saying, hey, let's make these exceptions and accommodations for neurodivergent students when it's this increasing number? If we train teachers from this neurodivergent affirming lens, it absolutely benefits the neurotypical students as well. Yeah. And then there's not as much accommodations, right? I'm sure you know this, but one that comes to mind is movement, right? Why have we trained students that they have to sit in desks all day long? That we don't do that as adults, right? We get up, we move around, we sit here and we fidget all the time. And so it's a really fascinating concept of system-wide change that needs to happen.
And that would also benefit the teachers because it would benefit the students, and that makes the teacher's job easier. And the teachers ultimately want the best for their kids. But I went to school many years ago. So I've been out for a while. So I don't know what they're teaching nowadays, but I could say for myself, autism and neurodivergence was not talked about. And I'm pretty young for a teacher. And there's many teachers that are older than me.
Yep.
We have no idea. I have some because I'm autistic,
right.
But these other teachers have no idea how to reach these kids. And it's not their fault, nor their responsibility, honestly, to dig more. And it's at the top, like something has to change.
Yeah, because like I mentioned, I graduated with my PhD in 2020. So not that long ago, I never once heard about neurodiversity my entire training.
That's shocking.
Isn't it? And I specialized in autism the entire trajectory of my graduate training. Never heard about it. I will say I was fortunate that I think there were some neurodivergent affirming approaches that were naturally happening, but I have also completely revolutionized how I provide care now. And this version of Taylor that was writing these articles, like definitely didn't know it. It was interesting as I was getting ready to leave academia and things that come out now, like even a shift to using identity first language is something we've incorporated, but we can't do better until we know to do better. Yeah. And I didn't know for so long. And I think like teachers, like therapists and clinicians in the field or pediatricians or primary care physicians, all of these people aren't getting this training. And so they don't know better unless something happens to change that trajectory of them learning, like your story, right?
Exactly. Yeah. I have one response from a nurse who has no neurodiversity that I know of in her, but she was saying how little she knows about these patients and she wishes she knew more about neurodivergent patients and sensory issues and whatnot. She wants to do better, but like you said, you don't know what you don't know, and it affects everybody. And which brings me back to my point, how I like to say, it does affect you. It does affect you. I'll show you how.
Right.
I'll show you why you should care.
It does affect all of us. Yeah, absolutely. And not only do we not do better until we know better, but the challenge becomes is our systems. This is something I feel really passionate about. Our systems are not set up to give us the ability to even have the space to go learn, right? So as a clinician, this is one of the many reasons I chose to be out of network and be able to craft services. I didn't want insurance dictating and telling me how I had to do services. But a bigger reason is it is allowing me to build a practice, to be candid, that supports my lifestyle. And why that's important is I keep a lower caseload, which then gives me all this time to be able to go learn and listen to autistic voices. And when I worked in the academic medical setting, I had such a high caseload, I was burnt out by the end of the day. So even if I wanted to learn, I didn't have the capacity. And this isn't about me, and I don't mean to, but an example of that hamster wheel that's happening. So I'm curious before we wrap up, and sorry, I didn't mean to cut off your thoughts with that, but I think it relates is, I know you're starting to do some advocacy work at the government level. Talk a little bit about what you're trying to change.
So yes, I am trying to. I have multiple ideas, like policy ideas in my head that I think would benefit. Basically, they all include more autistic voices. That's pretty much the boils down.
Yep.
But I started getting into how to make policies and what to do. And I set out to do it like it was no big deal. I'm like, oh, I'm going to write a policy memo.
I love it.
And then I was like, oh, shit, this is a lot more complex.
Yeah.
And you'll see that in my profile. If you go to the journey I'm going through, you'll see where I'm like, I'm going to write a policy memo. And then next week, I'm like, oh, no. Yeah, I got to start way before that. So that's where I am now. But I have always contacted my policymakers or voting organizations, whoever I think could change, could help. No one listens. No one responds.
Right.
And I can take some accountability. Like, I might not be doing my messaging correctly. So I might have to redo that. But it's a work in progress. And I'd love to see where I go. Yeah.
I will too. I am along for this ride.
I thought it was interesting if I showed how it's done. Other people might be inspired to do it. Where's their passions? Look at this girl who had a passion. I can do it too.
Yeah, it's true. Yeah. Yeah. And I know, like you said, I think this was yesterday, today, so recently in your stories too, you were talking about in terms of political affiliations. Right now, your goal is to get anyone to listen.
Anyone.
Yes.
Yeah. So I posted on my story something about, I posted on a Facebook page, mostly Democrats. But I had to specify. I was like, I don't care if it's Democrat or Republican or whoever, whatever you believe in, if you think you can help, who the hell am I to say, nah, I don't really this or this about you. I'm all for anyone.
Yeah, it's got to start somewhere. And right now, you're just trying to gain traction. So what I am going to say is, if anyone's listening to this right now and you have some political connections, please reach out to Beth and give her.
I would love it.
Yeah, some insights, any pointers or someone or whatever, because I think this is such a powerful thing that you're doing.
Yeah, and I can't do it alone. No one can do it alone. It takes a village.
It does. It does. Yeah. And then the other place that like parents or whoever's listening to this podcast can help is filling out the survey as well, because it's more collective voices.
I love diversity of, yes, I just want your stories, your specific diverse stories. I want them heard. If it's a good story, I want to promote that and show someone your story. So please fill out my survey.
Yes. We will link that in the show notes. We will also link social media accounts. I know I've referenced your Instagram where people can connect with you. But Beth, anything else before we wrap up this episode you want to make sure to share today?
No, but I am super grateful for you allowing me to talk about this. I know you're passionate. I'm passionate.
Yeah.
And I think this helps me with my messaging going forward, because now I can be like referring to this podcast and be like, look, like I might not have said everything, but look, you are helping me.
Well, good. So I hope. Yes. Of course. I think it's a really important message to get out there. And to be honest, I knew we were going to talk about the survey. I wasn't sure where this was going to go today, because I always have conversational episodes, but I think we covered so many important topics today in this as well.
Yes. I think it'll be a good one. I hope.
I know it will be. So thank you so much for being here and sharing all of this with us.
Thank you again for having me.
Yeah,
absolutely.
All right, y'all. That is a wrap for today's episode of Evolve with Dr. Tay. I will see you back here next time.
Before we wrap up this episode, for real this time, I want to share a couple ways you can get even more value and what your next steps could be. First, join the Evolve Facebook group. We do Q&As about the episodes and so much more. I linked that group, my personal social media pages, and any resources I mentioned in this episode in the show notes. So scroll down now and join me online. When you submit questions on any of my pages, your question could be featured on this podcast. How cool is that? I love being able to speak on topics that feel directly relevant to your life. Your questions truly make a difference in the content we create here. One last thing, do your fellow autism parents a favor. Share this episode on your social media and tag me. Autism currently affects 1 in 36 families in the United States and many more worldwide. So I'm sure there is a parent in your social media followers that could be served by this podcast. Thank you again for being here, and I'm so grateful we shared this time together. Bye, y'all.